What we're going to do today is we're going to have a look at a few basic things, then a motivation for where we see a few limitations of approaches that have been out there so far and quite well known. And we are going to introduce the formal model for there. We're going to do a short quiz on that. We're going to have a look at how dispatching looks from the inside. We will have a look at how dispatching problems can be solved with a few, or circumvented at least with a few other means, like type introspection, or we have a try at how generic interfaces might be applicable to a certain problem here. But in the end, we will come to probably more quite specialized topic, multi-dispatching, which will kind of be the goal which to reach in that specific area. Okay, so let's have a look at function calls from the very basics. So the most basic form, that's kind of the intuitive idea of functions, is the direct function call. That's a thing that, well, I'm going to use kind of C-like languages throughout most of the talk. So we're going to vary a little bit between C, C++, and Java, and then a few more exotic ones there. So that is the kind of ancient standard of C, C89. And what you could do there is, well, you would just specify a name for a function and its signature, so the return type and the parameter types, and then be able to specify a call to that thing in blocks of code. And what it would do, it would associate the call site with the definition side of a function, just via name, nothing more. That already gives us a few things that we are probably quite used to and nowadays. For example, overloading. What is overloading of function names? That is the idea of having two functions with the same name. We would specify them. So in a similar way, like that, both of the cases we have the same name, and the only way that they differ from each other would be via the parameters. So we have one version, one overloaded version of the println function here, with parameter int and one with parameter float, and now the idea would be that if we encounter a call site like this one here, it doesn't suffice anymore to just look at the name of the function, because there are several candidates of defined functions there out there that could be in principle associated with that name. So we now also need to take a look at the parameter, especially the parameter type, in order to dispatch between the functions. At least that's the theory. Luckily, that is something, if we still keep to old standards like C89, that's not allowed. But in principle, yeah, well, that just gives you a kind of an intuition of how limited such an old language standard actually is in terms of what we're used by now in using. So C89 is not allowing something like that. That comes from more higher level languages like C++ or Java. However, there's things like standards evolve, and although the number 11 is smaller than the number 89, that's still a newer standard, and well, it's actually just the two last digits of the year in which that has been standardized, so it's actually 2011, this one here. So there's a thing called generic selection. That might be something that you haven't heard of. I certainly have not had heard of that before. So there's new syntax that's introduced with that. You can now apply something like the generic keyword together with brackets. And then you're supposed to use an expression which is meant to be an identifier and something that's called a generic association list. That would be something with which you would be able to specify pairs of types and expressions. So that's what you see over here. That's the type name, then the colon, and an expression. And it is meant to be evaluated in a way that in case that the expression from over here has the type from over here, the whole expression would evaluate that way. And then if in case that there's just no match, you would have a way out with this thing. So question is now, how could that be helpful in any way? There's a certain programming pattern that you can use with that. So let's have a look at an example. And now it's a little bit time needed for parsing, I guess. So I give you a little bit of time and then start describing. So the overall goal here is to once again dispatch based on not only the name but also the type of the parameters. So based on the static signature of what you find over here, and it's solved in the way that we have println now not as a function but as a macro. So we can find that over here. And that will actually just evaluate to call on the printf with x as parameter. And then there's, as you might know from C, there's this thing that's a format string that you are supposed to use here. So that's what would have to go here. However, this is just another indirection. There's another macro here, and it's the macro from over here. And it says that the parameter here will be running through exactly that pattern that we have seen before. So it will make use of the generic expression. And this will select based on the type of the parameter. So this one here will be used for type-based dispatching. And depending on what we find here as a type, if it is signed integer, we will dispatch to this format string. Or if we find float, then we dispatch to this one over here. Thus, in the end, what we will get is we will have a type-based dispatch of the things that we find as parameters in println. We will generate format strings for that, and just put the value in the end, and that will lead us to something that quite looks like method overloading. Yeah. Maybe to wake up the hardcore C guys in here. Maybe people might be interested in why you would put the X in brackets here. Is that superfluous or on purpose? But are there C programmers in there? No C programming going on for your projects? Oh, that's a shame. Well, it will be an eternal riddle then. Okay, so overloading, how we are used to that. Let's have an example from, well, this case, the syntax is Java, but that does not mean that similar things don't happen elsewhere. So overloading, how we are used for that to work, is the way that we see over here. Here we have an overloaded version of the function f with two types, and depending on the type over here, one would assume that there's a different output. Turns out that might have been reasonable. So let's have a look at something else. Let's bring inheritance into the game. So now we have class D extending B, and we have a method F specified over here, and we have specified them with different parameters. What will I get as result for that? Any proposals?
Very much the same as before, but I fear it is.
So you say the same as before? So that was something like
3 and 3.6.
F int with 3 and F double with 3.6. Like that? Is anyone, or is there someone who disagrees? Well, that is in most parts now depending on kind of your personal history, how you progressed through the different languages. So that is one thing that's handled actually different between the candidates that we have here. So in Java, you will probably expect something like that, if you are with that. However, that's... Sorry? It overrides. So you say... F double 3.0 probably. If it overrides, no, it's 3.3. Yeah, that one. And the other one is same as this one. Mm-hmm. Well, actually. Yeah, that is one other opinion that you could have. So there's three opinions out there. Actually, that's what's happening. So there's actually no overwriting going on. There's overloading going on. And Yeah, so there are certain reasons for that, and I would defer the answer to your proposal a little bit. So that is what is in this specific approach in Java. You inherit overloaded methods. That is, before we come to what else is possible, let's have a look at what can happen over here. That's something that you buy into if you have a feature like overloading in your language. There's situations like this one here. Well, what would you expect as outcome for that one? Okay. There's a lot of shaking heads. You say error. Please repeat where the error occurs.
If you try to call f with 2 and 2 as parameters.
Yes.
Because both are ints, but I think ints can be implicitly cast into doubles.
Yes, they can. So, is it the runtime system that will complain? Is it the compiler that will complain? So you're completely right. It is an error, and it's actually the compiler that will complain here. This can be statically determined. So, what's happening here is that you have a look at the static type of the parameters. Static always means that you don't have to take into account any runtime information. The information that the compiler has is independent of the actual context in which the expression or statement that you have to create code for is actually in. So that's called static properties. That's properties that that don't involve any history, any path through the programs from start to that actual point. That's just static information, and so that is the kind of the compile time type of these things, and that's in this case int, and as you already said, this can be implicitly casted to double. And as this is just ambiguous here, you can either cast one or the other and then get a match for both of them. There's actually no ordering between the number of or the index of the parameter. So it just doesn't prefer anything to the other. Mm-hmm. So in this case, it will just say it's ambiguous and it's actually compile time error, as you see from here. It's the compiler that yields the error. Okay, so that is already a pathway to the method that's actually applied, how dispatching really works. So we have several components that you have to bring together. There's the there's the expression that you find in your code block, which would correspond to this one here, and then there's a collection of declared methods over here, and the thing is that what we want to have is that the control is dispatched from a method expression, method call expression, to a declaration which handles the call from over there. And the question is now, how is the connection between both of them made? So the thing to pay attention to is, as we have seen, the signature the static types of the involved things. They are determined. So these are the types T0 till Tn prime. And now is the question, when is a method declaration with types T1 to Tn applicable to an expression of types T0 prime to Tn prime? So these are the components of the function call expression to be dispatched. And there's the signature of that, which is, of course, the function name, which specifies kind of the group of candidates for that. There's the static or compile time types of parameters, and, of course, the return type, also the static return type, of course. And then there's concrete method candidates that provide handlers for the call expression. And they do that based on also a type signature. So the types of that is also playing a role. And the general rule of thumb here is that a concrete method is a method F is applicable to a method call expression F prime if F prime is a subtype of F. That's what this relation is all about. That's subtypes as a rule of thumb, because people always tend to confuse the way that you have to put the lesser equal around, is that you can imagine the lesser part of both being associated with the more specific types, because they are kind of less than the more generic ones. So that's kind of the rule of thumb that you have to remember for that. They're, the special ones are in relation to the general ones are a subset and are smaller, and that's why they are on that side. So that's kind of the thing to remember here. So how is that interpreted in the context of method signatures or function signatures? Well, subtype relation between one signature over here is a subtype of the signature with the primes. Now, when is that the case? Well, that is the case if you have to look at the types of the parameters T1 to Tn, and turns out that the static types of F need to be more general than the types of F prime in that case. So F prime's parameter types need to be more specific than the ones from F. So that is what this is all about. So in that sense, they're completely the other way around. You see, the for the methods, the subtype relation is in that direction. For the parameters, it's actually the other way around. So the parameters that stem from the method call from the left side are now on the right hand side. That's also called contravariance. Then, having a look at the return type, R and R prime. Here it's actually the case that the return type of F needs to be actually more specific than the return type of F prime. That's also called covariant. So That is what needs to be done. So a method is then a candidate for handling a certain expression if it actually is a subtype of the method expression. Is that the case? No, I think I got it actually the other way around. So the static type of the method expression needs to be a subtype of the of a candidate if it is applicable to that occurrence of method call. So with that established, we already have a rough idea of how to relate types to each other and when a call is actually dispatchable to something, or whether a declaration can actually handle a call or is applicable to a certain concrete static type signature. So let's have a look how something like Java actually works. For that, the nice thing about Java, that's why you see it so often here, is that you can actually access the front end and have a look at the sources. At least in the at the time when the slides were made, that was one of the few where you could actually have a look in there. And it was actually pretty decent in terms of readability. I think that has changed now. Not that this is not readable anymore, but there's more open compilers. But yeah, anyway. So the notion of is applicable in there is actually reflecting exactly that. The things that you see over there are actually not so important, so you can leave them out. That's just sanity checks. So that is the a method is applicable that kind of establishes the test whether the a certain member definition, well, it's called member definition, but what's in there is actually a definition of a method that is supposed to be a candidate for handling a certain signature, whether that is applicable to a method signature where the parameter types are given as what you see over here in the args. And there's a few sanity checks in there which are not so much I'm not so focusing on. The core is that there's a line over here where we run over all the arguments and just check that we check for the is more specific than the other property, and in case that the found argument in the method call expression is not more specific than the one from our candidate, then we yield false. So the applicability relation is just forwarding to the more specific, or that's actually the subtyping relation that's hidden in there. It's just in programmer speak. And is more specific than itself is quite straightforward for the basic types. The only question is now how is more specific handled when there's once again a method call treated, and in that case we would have the following code from here, and that's actually just implementing this subtype relation as we've seen before. You can check it for yourself. I think it's sufficient. So now the question is, which is more interesting to me, was how is the actual dispatching target selected if we find a certain method expression, and that's what you can find in the code generation part of the Java C compiler. Remember, that is the part that's run at compile time, thus that it has mainly static information. It cannot decide on anything that's related to runtime type information. So what's called there is a match method, and it gets the method name and its argument types, and it's now kind of looking for implementations of that. And there's a few not so interesting parts over here. We don't need to focus on them. But what's more interesting is that we have a loop on all the methods that are found that actually have the method name. And what we do there is we check whether we look at each of them separately via the handle method, and we then check for applicability to the method signature of the call expression via this one here. If it's not applicable, we just throw it away and continue with the next one. Then there's once again access stuff is not so interesting for us. What's more interesting for us is the way that we select our target in the end. And what we do there is we keep a candidate for dispatching to as tentative. That's this specific variable over here. And we always check whether the method that we have obtained in that run of the loop body, whether that is more specific than our intermediary target that we have found so far, in case that we have found one at all. And we do that once again with is more specific. So we use that is more specific notion also to compare several candidates. And with that, if we have found something which is more specific, then we exchange our tentative thing. And if we find something, a situation where where we see that that neither of them is more specific than the other, but both of them are applicable, that is this branch over here, and we build up the candidate list for the candidates that we couldn't decide between each other, and that is the output that we get in the compiler's error message. So that's how the whole thing is determined. We have run through all the possible candidates. We can obtain that from the class information with this all methods, and we can look up for specific names, and then we just run through all the names. Okay. Now, finally, to the thing that we have seen mentioned before, which was that there's fundamental differences between Java and C++, well, just in a certain way. The thing that overloading is carried over through inheritance is a concept that is very specific to Java-like languages, I'd say. C++, for example, does not automatically do that. So that we get something like this one over here, where we have the result that we get for an integer 2 here, also the same implementation like for the double version. Although we have an implementation that is more specific over here. The thing is that this might look quite alike to the result that we would get when there would be actual overwriting happening. However, that's not the case here. The case where we get that over here is that in C++, the overloaded things don't actually get included in the namespace over here. So we would have to do that manually. So only then we would get the overloaded function into the actual namespace and thus have to... I didn't get the beginning.
Only one of the functions would be defined in the namespace, the other one should be defined manually?
No, with that we integrate the overloaded version also in the namespace. So this using makes the other thing appear in there. Okay, so there's kind of a hiding in place. So now to the next topic, overwriting. That's something which is a little bit more different, because the things that we have seen so far are the things that are talking about purely static approaches. Overwriting is now something different to that. For that, we now move in the area of object-oriented languages a lot. So, few notes on object-oriented languages and their way to specify functions, or, well, in that call that case, methods, which are the specialized versions of functions in object orientation. On object orientation, the thing is that a very basic concept is that we associate certain types of things, in that case objects, with their, so to say, own functions. And with that, they become methods, and they are under a change of syntax, in the sense that in methods we explicitly stress that there's a very important parameter for that specific method call, which is from a concept point of view the receiver of, well, I say a call in the original proposal for the object-oriented systems. It was a message, but yeah, I think this the speak here is now more a call. Yeah, we're not small talk anymore, but in this case Java. So instead of method call, or no, a method specification like this one over here, where you would kind of specify your function somewhere in the void and always have to specify the first parameter over here, you would instead go over to a version where you associate each function with a certain object, thus becoming not a function but a method now. So that is what comes out of the thing. And since methods are always supposed to have a certain object or structure somehow related to it, we can leave the parameter that we had before which was this natural n before, we can leave it out and implicitly have it managed by the code generation system. So we don't have to specify that each and every time that we specify a new method. The question is now that I have gotten rid of my parameter declaration here, at least of my receiver parameter declaration. The question is now how do I access the first parameter if I have lost my identifier for that? And of course, well, everybody knows there is now this keyword this, and that is actually the reference to the object that we are talking about. But it's just kind of a cosmetics thing that's going on there. We just move the first parameter from within the parameters list to without. I stress that so much because in the next few slides, when we talk about how dispatching works in more advanced systems, I will still keep to the notion of a function like this, because this one over here is just working for one particular idea of how object orientation might work and how dispatching might work. And I'm going to drop that one somewhere later in there. So that is a special case that works if you have a receiver and if you dispatch based on that receiver. Later on, we won't do that anymore. Thus, we will throw that principle away. And that's also the cause why we keep to this way of talking about actual functions and methods. Okay, so in the object orientation, object-oriented languages with overwriting, we have a certain behavior in the sense that subtyping not also messes with the namespaces, but this also means that you can substitute the actual objects that you assign to some variable or other location of your choice by objects of a more specific type or also a subtype. In the example over here, you see that I specified my integral now as integral. Can use it like that. That's okay with the type system. I can also specify natural and use it. That's of course also okay with the type system. Then that's the special case in these languages. I can store my more specific object version into a location that is typed with the more generic type, and continue using that. And this will now be the one, I think, you said it, with overwriting. Here we are supposed to dispatch not to the original increase by, but to the more specific version here that is associated with natural, which is a special integer. So in dynamic dispatching, we have a new component that comes into our dispatching network that we have seen a few slides before. So that is all what you see here is parts that are done by compile time. So that is static information that is used over here. Now, when we do overwriting, we have something more that works here, and that is of matter here. And that is the so-called specializer. That is the one that is responsible for specializing a method call expression. And that will open up a whole new list of possibilities to which to dispatch to, and that depends on not the the compile time type, but the runtime type of the, well, in our cases, let's keep it to the first parameter. So remember, we're talking about functions here, not methods. So that is the receiver type. That is not the thing, if you look at something like Java, that is not the first parameter in a Java method, but that is the receiver type. That's the type of the class in which you find the method declaration. So, depending on the runtime type of the expression that's used over here, the dispatching changes to whatever the runtime type actually is. However, only in certain boundaries, because what's still done is that this part over here is still done in the compiler. Thus, it still only has static types as information. This has consequences in the sense that, first of all, this thing needs to be determined. Only if that is determined will we then choose whether there are appropriate candidates that do actually overwrite those things. Before we see certain consequences of that, let's have a look at how that can be implemented. Java does that. It actually dispatches based on the runtime type of the receiver. You have seen that in the example before. If you put something like that now through the Java compiler, it will, of course, use its static information to generate code. And what it will do is it will generate an invoke instruction to a method integral int by, and that small I is a basic type int. You might wonder now, I've put a natural in there, so my code should actually, if there is something like overwriting, should actually go to natural's implementation for the whole thing. However, you see that here we have a method called to a signature where the type of the receiver is actually an integral. That is what I have mentioned before with this blue bubble. That is due to the static information that is there. The thing is that a compiler does not necessarily find all the places where objects can be created directly above in the line before, as it is here. So in here we have a special case. Here the actual point where the concrete object that resides in I is just created over here. So we could, in principle, read from here what is actually going to be called. However, that doesn't necessarily need to be so. If you obtain your reference to an object from somewhere else via parameter or via some kind of global variable or something, it's not as easy as that anymore. In that case, you can't just say what there actually has to be. So that's why the compiler resorts to translating this thing here with just the static information local to that expression, which is a method call. And thus, it cannot directly put natural in as the receiver type in here, but instead it puts integral S type over here. Of course, there's always these things like optimization going on, and there might be things you could do about that. But in the general case, you would have to specify just the static type over here. And that's what the compiler actually does, because the Java C compiler does not do any optimizations at all. That's all due to the JVM, which performs the optimizations afterwards. So the question is now if we can observe that naturalist implementations of inkby is actually called, then invoke virtual must do something more special. So let's check the runtime interpreter of the hotspot VM, what is actually done with that. And after a lot of debugging and scanning source codes of the hotspot VM, you can in the end come up with the method that actually handles the resolving these things. And yeah, there's once again a lot of things, and I have annotated a few things there so that you don't get too confused if you read the things at home. But the thing to take away from here is a very concise one, and you don't need to read everything for that. So that, for example, is not necessary to know. This thing here does the actual lookup of the method. And how that works is it does a, it calls a lookup method in classes. Okay, so let's have a look in there. And what's happening in there is the core thing that's done there. So you start your lookup in the object that you, or in the class that is the runtime type of the object that you found in the in your expression, and then go through a loop that that iterates through the chain of superclasses. That's what you find over here. So you have these super things over here that give you the superclass of each of these things, and iterates from the concrete type, which is the most specific thing that you can find of your receiver, to more and more generic implementations of that, and yields the method that it gets through find method, if it has one, and if not, it just continues on with a loop. So the question is now what happens in find method. I've also put that one on here, but it's not as as important. For it just does what the name says. It's just going through the list of methods that is at that specific type, a valid entry, and searches for the right signature. And it does that with binary search, so that's why it's so lengthy. But that is in principle how the invoke virtual can be handled. So what we can take away from that is that in order to resolve the dynamic dispatch target for an invoke virtual, we go from the from most specific type that is associated with my object that I find from there to the most general through the super hierarchy, and try to find a match for the exact signature that we have determined through within the compiler's phase, where we determined the static type of the signature that might be a candidate for dispatching to. So there's two parts involved, compile time and runtime. Compile time is the Java C part, where we do static types. We determine a static signature for which to look in the second part of the runtime, where the hotspot VM gets to dispatch via invoke virtual, starting from the most specific version of the type of my receiver, down to the most generic one, and it looks for an exact match of the static type that it has found during compilation. Let's go straight to the fascinating examples. So it's once again for you to tell me what I could expect as outcome for that. So to explain things a little bit, the P thing is just an output. So that just gives anything that I put as parameter in there to the output. So that's not something where I do something special. Instead, we have two classes where B is inheriting from A, and we have methods M1, M2, M3, and parameters involved. There's subtyping in the parameters, there's subtyping in the receiver types, and there's, what else is there? Well, that's probably already all. But now we can put our ideas of how dispatching works to practice. So let's do that. Let's create a B object, like that. And let's also have an A object, like that. And then let's have a look at the call expression over here. What's the outcome? Java, it's semester one stuff, isn't it? Yes?
I very much hope it's in one of B and B, because else you lost me somewhere three slides before.
So you say M1, B, and B?
Yes.
Comments? Fine with that? No? Yes? Good. Of course not. Yeah, but these are here to make you realize that there's actually something going on here, and one needs to think about that. So you can decipher that by actually just trying to follow the parts that we have seen so far. So first of all, what we need to do is we need to make sure to know about the static types of the static type signature of that thing. So what's that? We need to make sure that we know this, the compile time type of compile time type of the receiver, which is the first parameter, and the first parameter of the method, which is the second parameter of the function. So the compile time type of A is?
A.
Good. Compile time type of B is? It's B. Good. Now, the next thing would be to locate a dispatching candidate. That is the thing that is going to be the signature that is going to be used for a parameter of invoke virtual. So, candidates.
Implicitly cast it to A, and you classes where the compiler has to implicit cast it. But for some languages, you have to simply say, okay, cast this to A and then it will.
So, when you talk about B, you mean this B?
Yes.
So the B front parameter. You say this is implicitly casted to
type of A.
Yeah.
It has to be because A has no candidate for a method with the parameter B.
And that now is the interesting thing. We start looking for a candidate, and we start looking in A and ignore B because, well, we have A specified over here. And B is more specific than the static type A that we find here. So all that we find in here is not suitable for being a handler for that thing because that is too specific. In our method call, in the method expression, we have just static type A. So that is too specific. We cannot use that. So we have to start looking in here for an applicable method declaration. What is applicable to M1 with type B? Well, we don't have an M1 with parameter B in here, so we choose this one. This is applicable, at least in general. It needs to be, it is more general than the type that we see here, but that's already sufficient. Okay, so that is the part that the compiler does. So the compiler translates that into an invoke virtual of A point M1A. That's not exactly the notation that you will see in the bytecode, but that suffices for our purposes. So invoke virtual of that thing now needs to be interpreted from the hotspot VM in its search for the exact match of that signature starting from the runtime type and especially from the most specific version of that down to at the end object. So the runtime type of the receiver is now the one that we need to look into. The runtime type of that thing, well, that comes from here, that comes from here, that comes from here. So the runtime type of the whole thing is B. So we start looking from B for the most recent version of that thing. But as I have stressed a few slides before, we are looking for an exact match. We are not looking for an applicable version, but it's an exact match. So what we are looking for is A.M1 parameter A. And yeah, the candidate that might have come to your mind was this one. However, that won't be the one that is yielded by the exact search for the signature because it has actually a B in there, which is not the signature that we are looking for. We're looking for an A. So this one is discarded in the search for a candidate, and we go because we can't find any. Oh, that was a little bit too much, but we can't find any direct match in there. We go over here, and here we finally localize this one, and that's why we find M1 of A in A there. So it's actually really important to know of both of these components. We have the static part performed by the compiler with compile time information. We have the runtime part, which is actually paying attention to what the actual type of the thing that you have as receiver is. And in you have to know about the way that they are communicating with each other. The compile time type is given to the runtime search. Let's try it again. Well, in that case, dare another try.
S to be N1 of B in B, because B is returned at compile time to type B. A is also type B, so it should actually be dot M1B.
Yes, also? Well, how can one be wrong with so many? No, it's actually, yeah, as you say. So there's no overwriting here. That's just for crap and giggling and yeah. Next one. It's just deceiving to use the A here and there. So there's no happening here. Now it's wrinkles. Other opinions?
I hear it's M2A and B.
M2A and B? Well, are there so many other possibilities? M to A and B. Okay, so why is that? It's yeah. Let I would say you're correct, but let's help let me help you in channeling these ideas. So there's two method calls involved here, so that's why there's several steps. So first of all, it had to happen at some point. It happens every time. So there's one variable involved is just B. It has runtime type and compile time type B. Fine so far. So let's have a look at the first call expression, where we first have to determine where this one goes. And well, even though I could now do the honors with all the static determinations and all that, there's only one candidate that is there anyway. So there's only one implementation where M2 has no parameters, and that will be this one. But let's keep in mind that this has had a static type of B over here, but a runtime type of B also. Well, so far so good. And it will be dispatched over here because we don't have anything else, and we inherit every method from there. So this will be visible by the compiler and will translate to the signature a.m2 for the first dispatch. So far, so good. Now, continue with the next call, which needs to be deciphered, which is this one here. So, in here, we have method name M2. Good. That's part of the signature. We can bring that on paper already. M2. Then we need a static type of the receiver. What's the receiver here? Sorry? The static type of the receiver. Receiver, if there's nothing here, then it's implicitly this. But what is the static what is the static type of something like this? Well, you can read that from here. So the static type of this is A. So for this one, we have A as static type. And then we need to think of what the static type of this is once again. Well, we had that already. That's A. So that is the thing that's given to the invoke virtual. This one is now not important anymore for the exact matching. We only match for parameter types. And we go through the chain of superclasses, starting from the concrete runtime type of, in this case, the first parameter of this. Remember what the runtime type of that was? That's this one here. It's B. Oh, that's still the eraser. So it's the B. So we start from B looking for that thing. So we start from there, and we find, oh, there's an implementation of that. So we will take this one to dispatch to. And that's why we read this one over here. Good. Yeah, there's a bunch more. M1. So, once again, there's just no other chance. We will definitely reach this one. So we can skip that step. The question is now, where do we dispatch to this time? And it's static types all over. This dot M1, we need static type for that. This one, that is A. Static type for the parameter, B. So that is the static type or the static signature of the call. Now, we need to look for a method that is applicable to this one, meaning that is more general, or at least as general as this one. And, well, what can it be? Can it be this one or this one? It's two choices. Anyone for green? Anyone for yellow? So let's see. Okay, so the idea is you need to find a more general, or at least as general, signature for that. And the thing is, you have the that was not what I wanted. You have remember, we still have this receiver type of the whole thing. For this one, we have the receiver type B. That is not general enough to be applicable for a static call like this one. Because this part is B here. So that is not possible to find. In general, you can say that in the part of the compiler where you locate candidates for dispatching to, you start from the class of we start from the static type of the receiver, which would be this one here, and go up the inheritance chain up until object. So you don't consider anything from the subclasses for looking for the static type or the compile time type of candidates to which you would dispatch to. So in the end, you will end up with this one as your signature to which to dispatch to, and then use that for your invoke virtual. And once again, if you use that for invoke virtual, you're just looking for exact matches in the subclasses, and that's not an exact match. That's why you'll end up with M1A in A. Oh, that was end instead of... Oh, nice. There's a lot more happening there. Yeah. Okay, then there's an M3. But we can skip that. That's just riding the train of the super keyword. That's just modifying the starting point of the search for a candidate to which to dispatch to during the compile time phase. So that's not in the core of what I want you to take away from that. You can think on that in at home at least, or in the tutorial. But we need to go over to the next best thing, which is multi-dispatching. That all should just make you aware of that there's a lot more going on that you might think in already the very basics of a language that you have learned in your beginner's days of computer science. So, yeah, multi-dispatching. That is an answer to a problem that arises when you have single dispatching in the sense that we have seen in the large-scale example, the last few things. So, the thing is, if you encounter situations where you would actually like to dispatch to more alternatives than just the ones based on the receiver type. For example, in this situation where you have something like the equals method, the Java programmers know that, of course. The way that this is solved in most codes is that you have this instance of tests, which relies on a thing called introspection, which enables you to have a look at the runtime type of the thing that you're going to encounter and then do something to react to that. But that works, of course, but burdens you with type safety yourself. So that's something that is out there, and it's a common programming pattern, but it's just not very nice. And it's only available for languages that actually have something like introspection. If you don't have something like that, then, oh yeah, have fun with that. If you could wonder whether you could make that more appealing by being more intelligent in the way that you specify your equality method, like over here where you would keep the type of the parameter open with a type parameter, for example, and then implement your equals method already on the right type and not bother with with casting manually and just have pleasing look of your code. Well, that would incorporate, of course, that you would dispatch to the right method. For that, you would need to have something like the equalizable interface and special sets that support on equalizable interface members and all that. And that needs another set implementation, but that's just kind of practical issues, I would say. However, doesn't compile. That is due to something that's called type erasure, and that will lead to things that are compiled from something like that will always get internally compiled down to not the concrete type variable, but to object. thus collide with the actual equal thing, and yeah, it's just not pretty. So that's no option here. The other idea out there is to go more into the depth of a language, and instead of performing single dispatching, as you have seen in the principle before, is you would prefer to dispatch not only on the first parameter, remember, the receiver, so it's not the first parameter of the method, but of the object itself, but based on every type of the parameter, not only the receiver, but also parameter 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever you can imagine. So you would introduce specializers for all of them. Well, you would have to do a little bit more about that. If you cannot just simply search for exact matches of a signature anymore with that, but instead you would have to rewrite your dispatching function, remember the one from invoke virtual, to look for the most specific concrete method, kind of similar to the overloading case that you had before. You would have to identify one with a is more specific than implementation of the method, and not stop if you have found just one match, but have a look at what's applicable and what's more specific. That can, of course, be done, but would have needed to be invasive to the hotspot VM. However, you can also do that by just instrumenting the code that's generated from your front end. So you can do all this this branching depending on the types of your parameters in the code that's yielded by the first part, by the compiler part, the bytecode, and then already implement all the dispatching in there, and then have just the standard hotspot VM continuing with that. Of course, you buy into a few specific properties that you get with that. For example, you rely on having a unique, most specific method for each of your method calls. Otherwise, you would run into this ambiguous things, as you have seen in the overloading part. That's just gonna return to you in the runtime once again, if you come to that, and that's just not very funny. Also, you have things where you get more ambiguities if you have multiple inheritance in there. And yeah, we'll have a look at those in the tutorial in a few days. So we'll see them once again. For code generation, you can just generate the methods separately from each other and have them uniquely named and dispatch them yourselves in a dispatcher method that you will call instead of the actual method call. And with that, that should work. And that's also an approach where you get, in terms of runtime overhead, a very small performance penalty, which you only have to pay in case you actually use something like that. In an example, how would something like that look like? In the case that we see here now, we would have a multi-dispatched method equals, where we would dispatch on the on the dispatching candidate. Wow, that was nice. Here, the object as the type for the candidate for which you would have to look out, and you would dispatch based on the actual runtime type natural in there. And with that, you could actually realize that the equals method from here is always dispatched to in case that your parameter has type natural. Well, pretty clean code at least. Behind the scenes, what's achieved by that is that you get an equals method, which is now not an equals method anymore, but instead is a dispatcher method that either dispatches to the original equals implementation from the object, or dispatches to a specialized version, depending on the actual type of the parameter that you go okay, up here. So the purpose of these parts, by the way, is not that you learn by heart the way that Java bytecode is specified on bytecode level, but to just give you an indication of what's actually happening behind the scenes. So what you should take away from that is that there is a check for the type, and those things are then jumped to. So here we go. Of course, that is just kind of an extension or a research prototype that's out there for multiple dispatching. But there's also languages out there which actually feature something like multi-dispatching. And yeah, who's going to be the candidate which I chose for? Well, of course, everybody's darling. Clojure. It's a Lisp dialect. Lisp is famous and loved because of its very clean code and many brackets that you use in there. I'm also sure that does anyone program or use Lisp or Clojure? Well, kind of. Okay. Good, good. So at least you can decipher what I've put on the slides, at least a little bit. Yeah. It's actually astounding. I had lectures with four or five Lisp programmers in the past, so these people seem to diminish in numbers. So anyway, Lisp is the Lisp list processor language. So the basic element in there is managing lists and process them in some way. And you introduce lists with the brackets, and that's why the brackets are everywhere, because it's all about lists. So, where are you? Yeah. So, brackets introduce lists, and everything you put in there with spaces in between is an element of the list. You can nest them as you want. That's all allowed. There's also square brackets. Square brackets are introducing vectors or some tuples of some sort. You can create functions as lambda expressions, as a list of several components. It's a list of keyword fn for the function. Then the second part of the list is a vector of identifiers that are thought of as being the parameters of the function. And the third parameter of the list is once again a list, and it's meant to be the body of the function. So, yeah, see, everything's lists, so that's Lisp processing. We can introduce hierarchical relationships with this derive thing, and then there's a few constructs for multi-methods, meaning there's the def multi, with which you introduce the static type on which you dispatch, and then this def method that's specifying candidates to which to dispatch to. So let's have an example. So we introduce a hierarchy between something we call child and parent. And, well, don't expect to be able to understand it immediately within 3 minutes, because that's all we have left now for thinking about that. It's just to take away that that there's actually languages out there which have it quite as a natural component to specify something like that. So what you do here is you specify your multi-method, that's a method that is dispatched in multiple dispatching. You give it a name. And the next thing that you specify here is some kind of dispatching function. Here, right now, what it does is it is a method that takes two parameters and gives them in the same form. Or well, it has one parameter, which is a vector of two components, and it gives the vector straight back. So it's just doing nothing. We will use we'll use that for something more more elaborate later on. So as candidates to which to dispatch to, we have the one over here, which we define as being the viable dispatch target in case that the parameters were of the form child and child. In this case, what will be done is with the parameters A and B, we will yield just child equals as result. And the other dispatch option is over here. This one will be considered the right dispatching target if the parameters have type parent. And what we will do is we will just do nothing with the parameters but give back parent equals. But we could do something more specific here in where we just return the string right now. And now if we call these things with this call over here, we do function on child child, what we'll get is the child equals version. Okay, so far that's not so very fascinating, because all we have done here is just given types as parameters anyway, but it's just for illustrating you the components. You can do it more elaborately in a longer example. Boils down to the thing that you somehow need to establish ways of querying your objects for their types. And the objects are the things that we generate over here, and they have several components, and we introduce them with accessors. So this here is the value natural that is stored under the accessor class. And this other thing here is the accessor class yielding object instead. So this is the notion of modeling something like these objects, where we have these accessors and values in a language that's not really dealing with such things. As natural is a kind of a special version of object, it also gets something more convenient, like this number accessor that yields a value that I use with my constructor, but that's just kind of trying to model the things that I do in object-oriented languages with the things that I've got from my system. And yeah, what's now happening is that in my dispatching function, remember that was the thing that was just yielding identity for, at the last slide, I now do something more spectacular. Well, spectacular, well, at least a little bit more advanced than before. I don't just yield what I get into that, but I query my parameter A for the class accessor, and this will just yield natural in the case that I have put natural object in there, or object if I have put that object in there. So, yeah, that's what's possible here, and in case that I get natural for both of the parameters, I will use the equality based on the number accessor's value, and if not, I will just always eat false. So that's how I have to read that. Of course, there's a lot of syntax going on there, but I don't expect you to be able to write closure, by the way. So Yeah. I know it's much, but that's the problem with program languages. If you want to broaden the horizon a little bit, you need to bring more languages into the game. Otherwise, well, it's just always going to be C, and that's not too fascinating, I would say. So, yeah, a language where that is included is this one here. You can even do more funky things like this one here, but due to time reasons, I think I will skip that. But you can not even do something only on based on types, but you can also use your dispatching function to compute something, and based on the result that you get from this computation, do a decision on where to dispatch to. And that's what's happening here. So I defined my dispatching function externally with that thing, and that dispatch my my function call based on, in this case, a salary that is associated with each of the positions, I think, and then I give certain certain keywords to that, and based on these things, I then dispatch and use these things. So that's already too much detail. If you have a little bit of spare time, you can look into that and have fun with multi-methods yourself. And maybe the user base of Clojure is growing then once again. Okay, so much for multi-dispatching. Yeah, there's a few things that you get with that. It's just that you've seen with these diagrams, it's just a quite natural extension of principles that are already out there. Why just dispatch based on the runtime type of the receiver type? That's just an arbitrary focus on one thing. Being more general would lead to multi-dispatching and giving would give quite expressive constructs with that. There's even situations where you have problems where you have to deal with runtime type dispatching. You do that with introspection so far. Don't know how to do them in languages that don't have that. The limited spoiler plate. And yeah, you buy that with moving your focus away from the privileged first parameter and get a little bit of runtime overhead, but nothing too spectacular. However, you might introduce a few no ambiguities. And with that, I think, yeah, we can go to just the last slide. And that's all. Thank you.